You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Coleman.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Can't complain. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Coleman Hughes, famous person, author of a recent book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Also host of the podcast, Conversations with Coleman, which I've been honored to be on. And you've been on my podcast before.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a musician and your various things. Like what else are you that I failed to mention?
A friend, a brother.
A friend and brother. I was about to say that. My friend and brother, Coleman Hughes. The way this came about is I was listening to your conversation with Joe Rogan, which was a great far-ranging conversation. I particularly enjoyed the stuff at the end about AI because I'm writing a book about AI and some of it resonated. The part that got my attention was the part about Gaza, where you and he had something of a disagreement. And he said, well, I'm not an expert, you know, but have you debated anybody on this? And you said, yes, Yusuf Munayyer. And I listened to that on your podcast. Very good conversation. I've had him on my podcast. Mm-hmm. But his perspective is different from mine. I mean, he's Palestinian. You know, I don't really feel an allegiance to either side kind of organically. My feeling is I'd just like to see the whole the Israel-Palestine conflict solved. And I do feel that one reason it hasn't gotten solved is because America has tended to view it more from Israel's perspective than the Palestinian perspective. But I thought, you know, maybe I would say some things you haven't heard so far in your debates. I admire the way you've gone out of your way to hear different views. You had the Israeli historian Benny Morris on, for example, and that was a good conversation too. So I want to get into Gaza and also just the whole background of the conflict. But first, as it happens, we're taping this at a time when some American campuses are in some degree of turmoil over the Gaza war. And the latest round kind of started at your alma mater, Columbia.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you kind of a free speech question because you've, of course, been very much associated with the free speech movement in the kind of context of so-called woke people trying to shut down campus speakers and so on. You're against that kind of shutting down. And now the free speech issues have arisen in a different context. So for example, the president of Colombia, whose name is Shafiq, was hauled before Congress, which lately has been a bad sign. If you're a college president who gets hauled before Congress, you got about a 50% chance of having your job a week later. She was asked about the phrase "from the river to the sea," and she said, according to the New York Times, that phrase might warrant discipline. That's the Times' paraphrasal. But I was wondering about how you feel about that, for example, as an issue.
It absolutely should not warrant discipline. It's absurd. Mm-hmm. Students should be allowed to chant from the river to the sea, so long as they are in accordance with other policies about physical harassment or, you know, directing harassment at particular individuals. Like, presumably you can't follow a student around campus, right? But you can chant from the river to the sea. Absolutely. You know, that slogan, the truth is that slogan actually means different things to different students. The truth is also that, and this is one of the general rationales for free speech on these kind of cases, is that the fact that, you know, from when Hamas says from the river to the sea, they mean get rid of the Jews between the Mediterranean and the Jordan by any means necessary, including violence. The fact that Hamas means that does not mean that the Columbia student who just got to campus doesn't even know what year Israel was founded, doesn't know which river we're even talking about. But because, and I know how this works because I went there, what happens is kids get to school, Students for Justice in Palestine goes door to door in the freshman dorms knocking, and they give you a flyer that says there's an apartheid in Palestine. Israel's an apartheid state. People protested South Africa. This is a simple issue of good and evil. And a lot of kids say, okay, well, heck, sign me up. I mean, I don't like evil. And from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Well, Palestine's not free. I want them to be free. It's really that simple for a lot of students. So to prevent them from saying that on the grounds that many other people mean something close to expulsion and genocide by it, I don't think is fair. And I'm absolutely a proponent of free speech on all of these issues. That said, if protesters are actually violating existing policies, it's like, I don't know what the policy on encampments are. I don't know if there is a policy on encampments, but presumably other policies are implicated if you're actually disrupting the flow of like movement, or if you're trying to create a zone that certain people of certain politics can't enter. Presumably that should violate a policy, right? Like if I were to create me and my friends were to create a zone on Columbia's campus and said socialists can't enter this area, and we're going to make a human link, a human mm-hmm. chain to prevent this happening. Presumably this is violating some policy. So you can't do it with Zionists or presumed Zionists either. So that's the distinction I would draw.
Yeah. Well, God bless you for saying the phrase means different things to different people, because I don't think a single college president, when interrogated about that before Congress, has said that fairly obvious thing. They've all felt obliged to say it's abhorrent, I'm offended, and not give it any more nuance than that. And people can be reasonably offended given the way it's used in some context. But it seems to me, if you're a college president and you don't understand the different interpretations of it. And I would say, I don't think it's just naive, uninformed students who adopt the phrase not knowing what it means. I think some of them, you say, what does that mean to you? They'll give you a very clear idea. They'll say, I think, for example, Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank should be allowed to vote in Israeli elections, for example. Some people might say that. Now, the long-term implication of that might be bad for Zionism, and it might be, and so on. But I think there is certainly a range of things meant. And I think it's actually used by a lot of knowledgeable people who don't mean drive the Jews into the sea. If the long-term implications of what they mean would be bad for Jews and could turn out to be very bad, you know.
Right. But so I would say that's a different species of naivete, in the sense that, you know, thinking having a Palestinian majority democratic state between the river and the sea would mean anything other than Jewish flight and Jewish expulsion, I think is naive. But then we're getting into a substantive disagreement, right? This mm-hmm. is a substantive disagreement about how I model the conflict versus how someone who's pro one state solution like Yousef Munayyer might model the conflict. I mean, part of our disagreement was that Yousef believes a one state could be like a pluralistic, you know, human rights respecting, minority rights respecting state, mm-hmm. and that the Jewish minority in a Palestinian one state could live, you know, something like the Arab minority lives in Israel, where they can vote and they're not exterminated and they're not driven out of the country and so on and so forth. And I think that's extraordinarily naive. But then that's getting into a substantive disagreement. Mm-hmm. Right? So mm-hmm. for me to say that anyone who says from the river to the sea must be okay with what I think the consequences of that would be, that's absurd. I mean, they have a materially different, some of them, as you say, have a different perception of what that would entail. It's naive, I would argue, but they absolutely should be allowed to say it. They should be allowed to write it in the campus newspaper. And I should be allowed to call them naive. That's how free speech works.
Okay. Let me ask you, before we get into Gaza and the history, one more question about the free speech issue. It has long struck some of us that some of your allies in the one version of the free speech issue having to do with wokeness on campus and so on you know, the form of the debate that we were seeing, you know, 10 months ago, are not consistent on this issue. And I'm thinking of Barry Weiss in particular. I mean, I've written about this in the past. I wrote about it almost as soon as this intellectual dark web thing became an issue, because, you know, she's, I mean, first of all, strongly pro-Israel, which is fine. But some of the things she said, at least in her book of a few years ago, include, and I'm interested in how you feel about these substantive claims, but also whether you consider it a form of speech policing, and I'll explain why I do. So she said that to be anti-Zionist is to be anti-Semitic. And she has said that Ilhan Omar is anti-Semitic because of her, you know, the root of the allegation has to do with her. It's all about the Benjamins line. And when people said, what do you mean? She said, I mean, AIPAC. So in other words, she was saying there's a lobby that exerts influence on politicians by giving out money. You wouldn't think that's like a super necessarily controversial statement. People like Barry Weiss say, well, when you understand the whole history of anti-Semitic tropes and so on. But in any event, to my view, this is part of a fairly long history in America of some staunchly pro-Israel people trying to police speech about Israel by smearing people, by stigmatizing people with the allegation that they are anti-Semitic. So if you're going to say anyone who takes objection to Zionism, you can certainly imagine someone saying, well, I'm just against systems of government, including Islamism, that give any kind of privileged position to any ethnic group. So I'm against Islamism, I'm against Zionism. You can imagine that as a coherent position that doesn't grow out of anti-Semitism. She has said, if you are anti-Zionist, you're anti-Semitic. So I'm interested in your view on whether you agree with her on that, A, and B, whether you think I'm reading too much into it to think that this is a form of trying to police speech. It's different. It's different from trying to shut down a campus speaker in the way it works, but I consider it unhealthy speech policing.
So I won't speak about Barry's views because I actually haven't read what she has to say on that. But on the topic more generally, no, I don't think anti-Zionism is necessarily anti-Semitism. I mean, anti-Semitism is, I take to be bigotry against Jews in general, against Jews in particular as an ethnic group or perhaps as a religious group, akin to racism against other groups. How anti-Semitism kind of differs from racism against other groups is that it often is wrapped up in this conspiracy that the Jews control everything. The Jews were behind World War One. The Jews were behind World War Two. I mean, like this is the stuff of Nazi style anti-Semitism, and it is a little bit different than the shape of, say, bigotry against Black Americans, which has never really taken the shape of a conspiracy that Black people control the world. For instance, it's more often that, you know, Black people are lower than, are less than. So, the question is, Is anti-Zionism coextensive with that sort of anti-Semitism? I think the truth is anti-Semites are almost all anti-Zionists, but not all anti-Zionists are motivated by anti-Semitism. Many anti-Zionists are motivated by the sense that Israel is a colonial entity. That's their view. I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding of what Israel is. I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the conflict. But I think it's out of that misunderstanding that a lot of people oppose Zionism, I suppose. I mean, I find Zionism to be a kind of weird word, as well as anti-Zionism, because it made sense. You know, the Zionists were people who wanted to establish a Jewish state in historic Palestine. Once the state was established, validated by the UN, has existed for 75 years, what does it mean to be a Zionist? It means that you support the continued existence of the state?
Well, I would say, some people would say there are features that continue to exist in the state For example, if you're not Jewish, it's almost impossible to immigrate. I had Daniel Levy, who was Israeli, maybe Israeli-British, and was a negotiator on the Israeli side or was on the staff. And he explained to me there still are situations in Israel proper, where I'm talking about the West Bank, where there can be a piece of a land or a house or something. And the rule is, no, you can't live here because you're Palestinian. Now, that is, I think those are narrow cases, and I forget the specific situations, but there are still senses in which Israel is a Zionist state in the sense that Jewish ethnicity is in some sense of the word privileged, I think.
Though I assume that there are Zionists who don't necessarily agree with those laws. So, for example...
Oh, sure. I'm sure Peter Beinart doesn't. And he, well, some Zionists would say he's not a legit Zionist. but even you're
Benny
absolutely
Morris,
right. Your point is right. Yes.
Yeah, even Benny Morris said that he doesn't, I believe, if I recall, he said he doesn't support the Aliyah laws anymore, that privileged Jewish immigration.
So anyway, that was just a footnote. But
he's
go
still
ahead.
A Zionist. Anyway, mm-hmm. the point I'm trying to make, I think, is that there's no word for someone who supports the continued existence of America. There's no word for someone who supports the continued existence of Canada or Australia, which are in every way, I think, more colonial entities than Israel is, in my view, though we can table that discussion for now. But, you know... Nobody wants to destroy other states, right? There's no wide base of people really that want to undo states except for Israel at this point. And so that's the only reason the word Zionist, I guess you could say, even makes sense, or the word anti-Zionist makes sense at this point in history.
I mean, you're right. It's funny. I at some point I realized I'm a Zionist because I favor a two-state solution. And if there were a two-state solution, that would be an affirmation of the Israeli state as it exists. So, I guess I'm a Zionist. So let's talk about Gaza, and then get into the history a little. So one thing you said on the Rogan podcast was, I think you're in favor of the continued war in Gaza. You thought the, you know, level of civilian casualties justified given the situation, you know, urban conflict and so on. And you said, I think you said the reason the war needs to continue is you need to, quote, cut out the cancer. And that signifies a particular understanding of the nature of the problem to me. In other words, that Hamas is the root of the problem. And if we could just get rid of everyone in Hamas, maybe by killing them or whatever, I mean, in the armed forces of Hamas, of course, it was also kind of the government. So there were a lot of people in one sense or another associated with it. But the Hamas so-called militants or soldiers and command structure, then that would solve the problem. And I don't agree with that because, you know, I think it's certainly true that Hamas has an infrastructure that creates militants. But the way it does it, and by the way, I would recommend a documentary, which I've recommended before, called Death in Gaza. If you go to YouTube and write Death in Gaza documentary, it's an HBO documentary from like a little more than 20 years ago. And you see this super creepy scene of these Hamas guys trying to convince this like 14-year-old or something that like martyrdom would be fine. And so it does cast Hamas in a dark light, but it also shows you that what they're doing is converting hatred of Israel and Israelis into militants. That is the raw material they feed on. And you see in the course of this documentary how many Palestinian kids have relatives who have been killed. This is during the occupation. So it's more like what's in the West Bank right now. This is before Israel withdrew the settlements in 2005. And you just see that, like, to these kids, all the only Israelis they see are Israelis with guns, and they all know somebody or have a relative who's been maimed or killed. And so, obviously, under those circumstances, A, Hamas isn't going to have a recruiting problem, and B, if you wipe out Hamas, I think some form of armed resistance will, given enough time, again, develop. It will depend, whether it develops will depend on how much hatred there is. And what we're seeing in Gaza, I think, is a just massive ramping up of the hatred. It was already pretty extreme, I gather. But now you've got, when you've got more than 1 in 100 civilians having been killed, probably the number killed or maimed is like 1 in 25 or something at this point. Everyone in Gaza is going to be able to point to a relative, often a very close relative, a friend who's been killed or maimed by Israel. To me, that means that even if you kill everyone in Hamas, unless you resort to something like ethnic cleansing, which I fear a number of officials in Israel may be hoping for, but unless you resort to something that extreme, you're just not solving the problem. So do you agree that, do you have like a different theory of the case than mine? Or do you just think, well, Israel has to do whatever will work for the next few years or what?
Okay, so one thing I would say is I agree that the cutting out the cancer analogy is not, in my view, wasn't really meant to convey that the problem would be solved if you kill Hamas militants in Rafah. I think the problem is obviously much, much bigger than that, in the sense that the people of Gaza agree with Hamas's stance on Israel to a disturbing degree, even before October 7th and certainly after.
Mm-hmm.
And that I agree with that the people of Gaza form a kind of constant basis of recruitment for Hamas-style jihad against Israel. One thing I would push back against is I think that the level of hatred of Israel prior to October 7th was close to as high as one people can get for another. I mean, you know, you already had a situation in which children were being taught in kindergarten that the Jews want to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque and rebuild the temple, blow up one of our most sacred sites. This is as close as you can get to 10 in terms of weaning children on hatred of Jews and hatred of Israeli Jews in particular. And yes, I think that, you know, to say that bombing Gaza to this extent doesn't solve the problem is it's true, but nothing solves the problem, right? There is no simple solution to this problem, so I don't view that as kind of a knockdown argument. I think Israel is clearly in the problem management game right now, and not in the solutions game, because it's not a given that every problem has a solution at every point in time, right? Sometimes problems can only be managed. So how does one manage the problem? Well, I think that if you're a sovereign nation like Israel, and you have a terrorist group on your border that is sworn to destroy you, doesn't want to live peacefully, doesn't want a two-state solution, doesn't even pretend to, doesn't talk about issues that are even in principle changeable, right? Hamas doesn't talk about the settlement expansion in the West Bank. They talk about the fact that the alleged fact that Jews want to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that, you know, the Zionist entity needs to disappear fully, and that they'll do 10,000 more October 7th in service of that. And you have a situation where they're sending rockets, where you've had to do what really no nation state has ever had to do, and get so sophisticated with your defense technology that you have the Iron Dome, and that every house has a bomb, a bomb shelter. And then all of a sudden, all of these sophisticated defenses fail, and you have October 7th going house to house, burning families alive. So what do you do in this scenario? Well, you have to get rid of this as a problem management task. As a state, you have to get rid of the threat if you're able to, right? So I don't think that Israel can get rid of Jew hatred in Gaza. I don't think they can get rid of, but what they can do is prevent Hamas from being able to launch military attacks and launch thousands of rockets. That's an achievable task. That's problem management. And I think it's a completely legitimate war aim, given given what Hamas did and what Hamas is going to continue to do.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my argument would be, well, actually, I mean, what I'm saying is, given my theory of the case, if you, quote, cut out the cancer, you're just buying time. And if you want to buy time, if you want Israel to be secure from something like October 7th for 5, even 10 years, you can do that now. I don't want to get into this whole argument about why, let alone the argument about how why Israel, as the war goes on, is in other respects imperiling its security, including imperiling future support from the U.S.'s, which is critical. But that's just my view, and I think not an argument for today. I would say on the question whether the hatred had gotten as high as it could, almost in your view, you know, I suspect you could have said the same thing when this documentary was made. I mean, certainly all the ingredients were there for hating Israel, and everybody kind of seemed to, but you still saw some of the 13, 14 year old kids making the decision to join the militants and some not. And you saw mothers anguishing over it. And the 14 year old says, I want to be a martyr. And she says, no, please don't. And these variables can all can get worse, I think, in terms of how many mothers resign themselves to it or even say, what else are you going to do? After all, my daughter was killed by them. Of course, my son's going to become a martyr. So I think, you know, it's always easy to say how much worse could things get? Things can always get a lot worse. You know, I mean,
right.
Along every dimension, things could get worse.
Fair enough. But I presume if you had been talking in 2003 or 2004, And you were talking then, so you can tell me what you said. But I imagine along these lines, you might have argued, well, Israel has to get out of Gaza, get out of the business of lording over people in Gaza, because this is creating more terrorists. Every time you have to push up some Palestinian boy against a wall and check his pockets for knives, you're creating the next terrorist. So why doesn't Israel just pull out of Gaza? Right. I mean, that's how that logic would have run based on that decision. And what did you get? Did you get less hate? Well, no. Immediately you got rockets, and then eventually you got October 7th. And so if I'm putting myself in the shoes of an Israeli, how has this sort of thinking worked in the past? This sort of don't make decisions to not further anger and create hatred. How has that sort of logic worked in the past? Not very well in the long run. In the long run, the hatred seems to be sufficient hatred to provoke October 7th style stuff, no matter what you do. Now, I'm not saying it can't vary above or it can't vary within some parameters, but the parameters within which it varies are at the low end of that parameter is like October 7th is possible. And at the high end, who knows what? I mean, genocide. We're basically talking about levels of hatred that provoke various like intensities of genocide. So I think it would be very tempting if I was an Israeli to say, managing their level of hatred of us is a losing game because we're managing it between a 9.9 and a 10. What we have to manage is their ability to harm us, right? That's something that can vary greatly. Mm-hmm. We can be either like very secure, or we can have October 7th. And the difference between those two things is a lot more important than the difference between whether Hamas can recruit 100 14-year-old boys in Gaza or 1,000. That would be a very tempting line of reasoning.
Okay, so you seem to be saying Israel has made good faith efforts in the past to solve the problem, didn't work. And I think this is a common issue to ultimately arise in these debates. I think ultimately when you press people on their positions on Gaza, why is it justified to kill all these civilians in the course of pursuing the militants and so on? Or you interrogate people on the other side. The conversation gets back to, well, you know, this side tried, that side tried. Obviously, the other party didn't want to play ball. This is especially commonly, you know, there's this famous phrase, the Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Commonly said about, I don't know if you have said in the past that they were offered a state and turned it down. I don't know if that's your view, but it's commonly said, right? Mm-hmm. Is that your view?
Basically, yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned the fact that I was writing about this stuff long ago. One piece I wrote in 2002 for Slate was called Was Arafat the Problem? And it was about the Camp David offer that he famously refused. There's two offers that were famously that didn't lead to anything. And the point I made is that, I mean, my view is, so there was Camp David early 2000, and then at Taba at the very end of the Clinton administration when Bush was about to come in, and I think there was going to be a change of regime in Israel as well. So that was maybe that was January 2001, I guess. So as for Camp David, so here's what the Palestinians were offered. I don't see how anyone could call this a sovereign state. They were not going to be allowed to have a military. They were not going to be allowed to control their borders. And Israel was going to be allowed to dominate. They were not going to have control of their airspace. Israel's going to be allowed to fly jets in their airspace when it wanted to. It was going to be allowed to have a road that bisected the Palestinian state that at any moment it could declare a state of emergency or something and control. So, like, these things are just, you know, you name something that exists today and call it that you call a sovereign state, and I guarantee you that's not the description it fits. Sovereign states get to have a military. They control their own airspace. They control their borders. That's what they were offered. Now, in my mind, it gets actually even worse than that. So, you know, there is the problem of the settlement. And by the way, I mean, a brief tangent on the settlements. They start after the 1967 war. Right after the 1967 war, this is recounted in Gershom Gorenberg's book, The Accidental Empire. If I'm recalling correctly, the Israeli Foreign Ministry seeks a legal opinion on whether settlements would be legal. The opinion is no. And the reason is the Fourth Geneva Convention prohibits the transfer of civilian populations into territory acquired by force. So it's really quite clear cut. And by the way, this is not some kind of abstract principle of international law. Geneva Conventions are treaties. Israel signed and ratified the Fourth Geneva Convention. So every settlement violates not just international law, but a treaty Israel signed. They started building them. They kept building them. They've kept under every single prime minister. Okay, so as of 2000 at Camp David, this was a problem because there were now so many settlements that, you know, Israel is saying we can't evacuate all of these. We can't give you all of your state back. So the deal was there would be land swaps, right? We're hanging on to settlements but in return, we're going to give you land in that now is part of Israel proper. Now, probably it was not specified what land that was. Probably would have been inferior since the settlements were on carefully chosen terrain. But do you know what the ratio of swap? I mean, you'd assume it's a one-to-one swap, right? Isn't that what would be fair? Acre for acre?
I suppose, yeah.
Do you know what the ratio was?
What was it?
9-1. Israel said,
you're talking about Camp David?
Camp David. The ratio got better at Taba, but it didn't get to 1-1.
Okay, but okay. The Clinton parameters were a much better deal, and it was also turned down.
The Clinton parameters of Camp David.
96-97% of the West Bank, something like this, when you account for the land swaps, right?
Well, there's two things. So at Taba, Israel was going to hang on to 9% of the West Bank and in return give the Palestinians an amount of land in Israel proper equivalent to 1% of the West Bank. Okay. I don't understand. It's one thing to go in with a tough bargaining position, but it seems to me this is the kind of thing to do if you want to so insult people that they'll just walk off, which is what Arafat did. It was very frustrating to everybody that he didn't make a counteroffer. But let me just say, what I've just described was on the table. So anyone who says Palestinians were offered a state at this point has a very different conception than I do of what a state is, A. And I'd love to hear their justification for why 9-1 makes sense. When, remember, the settlements that are being compensated for with land swap were illegally acquired, okay, just judging by a treaty Israel signed. Now, in Taba, things got better, but it got to 2-1, okay? That's way better, the ratio, but still, and some other things got better, but they were still going to have no military, not completely control their borders, and the final offer was 2-1. Now, at Taba, everyone knew time was running out, right? You were going to move from the Clinton to the Bush administration. I think Ehud Barak was still prime minister of Israel, but that was about to move far right. The time for fooling around is over, right? You got to get serious. And if you understand the political situation Yasser Arafat faced, and you understand that at that point, there were still a lot of Palestinians who remembered having to flee their homes in the Nakba. And there were and there were tons of them whose parents had told them that they had fled their homes, okay? And so, and for him to go back, given the fact that there were radical elements, remember, the PLO had moved toward moderation. They had recognized Israel's right to exist. They had come a long way. They were once as radical as Hamas. And they had come a long way. And now you're asking him to go back, given the fact that he faces a political threat from true radicals, and say, look, we couldn't get 1-1. I mean, I just think that's crazy. So in light of this, if we stipulate that these accounts are accurate and the piece I wrote, was Arafat the problem? People can fact check if they want. Would you say, A, the Palestinians were offered a true state, a sovereign state, and B, they were ever offered a fair land swap?
Okay, so my understanding from my memory of having read books on the subject, in particular, Shlomo Ben-Ami's book, his recent long book, he was at Camp David. He was across all of these negotiations. The Camp David, the ending offer at Camp David was 91% of the West Bank. The Clinton parameters, which was much better. It was 90.
It was.
Between 94 and 96% of the West Bank, 97% at the highest, if you account for the land swaps. This is also rejected by Arafat.
However, I think
here's the more important point, which to me jumps off the page in most accounts of the negotiations, is that for someone like you, the percentages and the land swaps may have been a big issue, but for Arafat, for the Palestinians, the sticking points were Jerusalem and refugees. If you wave a magic wand and make Israelis and Palestinians agree on Jerusalem and refugees, the land swap issues could have been sorted. Mm-hmm. They would have found a percentage that was not the crux of the disagreement. The number was not the crux of the disagreement, though it took a lot of negotiation, obviously, because they both wanted to get the best possible deal in the best possible number. It was not actually the deep core of the negotiation, which could not in principle be agreed on. Refugees and Jerusalem were the core of the problem. How do you divide Jerusalem? There are some Israelis that don't want to divide it. Arafat was by all accounts extremely focused on Jerusalem. Abbas was more focused on refugees, meaning that, you know, how many Palestinian refugees scattered, you know, in Lebanon and other countries can return not to the new Palestinian state, mind you, which would be the logical endpoint of a national movement would be the ingathering of its exiles to its state. That's not what they wanted. They wanted hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees to go to the Israeli state, which would, of course, make Israel, millions, which would make Israel a Palestinian majority state, an Arab majority state, which would defeat the point of two states for two peoples, which is the idea of the two state solution. And so my view is that there was no meaningful compromise on refugees. My view is that really Arafat and a critical mass of Palestinians, unfortunately, want the end of Israel much more than they want a sovereign state. I mean, I think that's a fact about what they're.
You think you would call it a sovereign state if it can't have a military and doesn't control its borders? You would call that a sovereign state?
It's the beginning of a sovereign state. I mean,
there's been
many demilitarized states, right? There's been, especially after that state, it has been belligerent and I mean, what were our conditions on Japan and Germany after World War II? I don't know the precise details, but there was certainly demilitarization and so forth.
The legal context of that was very different, but it was a conquered state.
But the security context was not different. The security rationale is when you have a belligerent state and you're seeking peace with it, you want something more than a verbal guarantee, at least in the first 5 or 10 years, that it's not going to immediately go back to war, given its very recent pattern of belligerency.
Yeah, let me say, I mean, first of all, you're pointing to a second sense in which the offer had improved as far as land goes between Camp David and Taba. Israel's asking to hang on to less of the West Bank, more like 3 or 4%, not 9%, and the ratio had increased, but it was still like 2-1. And I just don't, if you're right, and it really was boiling down to right of return, I want to talk about that a little. Why doesn't Israel just like crystallize that fact and be reasonable on the other front? Like, why are they even going into it? And they know they've got like a couple of weeks left and saying anything other than, okay, 1-1, obviously nothing else is going to be considered fair by your people. Why do we do that? They didn't do that. On the right of return, first of all, as for Jerusalem, the old city of Jerusalem within the walls, that, of course, was not part of pre-1967 Israel. That was conquered during the Six-Day War. It was never designated as part of Israel by the United Nations. So that was part of the conquered territory. So, yeah, it's problematic. Clinton was proposing, I think, that it be, in some sense, an international city or shared something or other. The right of return, which again, very explosive political issue among Palestinians. I saw another documentary, I wish I could remember the name, about peacemakers on the Palestinian and Israeli side pre October 7th. And one of the Palestinian peacemakers, you know, they were meeting with the Israeli doves and everything, and it was nice. And they showed him trying to sell the idea of two states to his wife. And she just wasn't buying it. You know, it's like I'm sure she'd grown up. Her parents had told her, no, your home was in Israel. And she just wasn't gonna go with it. Now, I'm not here to defend her position. I'm just saying that is a widespread view in Palestine. And so obviously for Arafat, that is a right of return. Of course, the official right of return would mean all Palestinian refugees from the Nakba and their descendants, presumably, be allowed to return. Of course, that would be death to Zionism and probably in the long run, bad news for Jews. So obviously,
why would it not with high probability result in simply those two states joining and becoming one Palestinian state.
Yeah, no, obviously Israel's not going
to. It's more
Israel's
than
not going to.
It's more than a negotiation parameter. It's a killing of the deal.
No, I get it. That's, Israel is not, just as Palestine is not going to live with anything other than one-to-one and is going to insist at least nominally on right of return, Israel is not going to live with any thoroughgoing version of right of return. I understand that. It's a political matter. But I would say that...
There are different issues, though, because if Palestinians could agree to 97% with no right of return, they'd have a state. Whereas if Israel agreed to the full right of return, they wouldn't have a state.
I'm not asking so Israel not, to agree
not equally,
to that.
They're not asking, equally unreasonable. They're not equally
I have not brought this up in this respect. Okay, I'm not saying Israel should have offered full right of return. I mean, I just don't think it's realistic to expect it politically of Israel. And I understand why. My sense at the time was, based on things certainly that Arafat was saying, I mean, but you know, both Arafat and Abbas had a political problem. They got to sell the deal. My sense was that it was soluble with enough creativity and money, basically. In other words, you ultimately compensate Palestinian families who don't return very heavily financially. Now, I don't remember the details of that. My main point is that it is like routine to say Palestinians have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. They turned down states. A, I don't think they were ever offered a true state. B, I think the weird thing about the land swap ratio suggests that Israel was either being bizarrely tough in its bargaining or wasn't interested in the deal. I don't know which. But my main point is it's just unfair to say that okay, it's too bad it's come to the slaughter in Gaza, but the Palestinians have always been just so unreasonable. I think I have pointed to senses in which you cannot infer from the way these things unfolded. And remember, with Taba, there was just not much time left. They just ran out of time, basically. They didn't pursue right of return to its full potential resolution. I do not think you can infer from the Palestinian positions they weren't interested in a state. They weren't being reasonable. And that is an important, that the claim that they were unreasonable is an important part of the narrative of people who say, sorry, it's come to this, but you got to do what you got to do, right?
So I don't call it unreasonable. I think that, or I won't call it unreasonable in the following sense. I think you're failing to distinguish what's important to you, Robert Wright, journalist, third party, from what's important to Palestinians. And what's important to Palestinians is captured by the story you told about the guy's wife. Mm-hmm. The right of return is a sacred issue to them. Okay, so let's not call it unreasonable. Let's call it sacred. Everyone has their, you know, things that are sacred to them. It is a sacred issue to them. It's not an issue. It's an issue that it's extremely difficult to sell to Palestinians that rather than the right of return, you're going to get a certain amount of money, no matter the amount of money. That's built into the concept of
we don't know that. Right? That's a hypothesis. We've never tried, but go ahead. And I think, frankly, sacred is a little. It's almost a form of belittlement. It's like if you describe the history in the Nakba, it's just not surprising that they would have this feeling, right? This is
no,
the kind
not,
of thing that fosters agreement.
It's not a given.
Yeah.
How many people were expelled from their homes in the 1940s? Millions or tens of millions, if you're talking about the people that were expelled in Europe, that never got to go back, Polish, Turks, Greeks, etc. None of them have developed a narrative wherein people in the year 2020 have the mm-hmm. key around their necks to the homes that their grandparents or great grandparents lived in. That's not
well. They do have a state. They have a state. They live in a place where they have rights. Palestinians on the West Bank don't. The people you described have a state to live in where they are secure and free.
Even Palestinians that do live in places where they have rights, nevertheless, have the narrative.
Who are those Palestinians? Where do they live?
Well, Palestinians that are scattered around the world. I mean, I've heard of. There are Palestinians that are like that live in America that are like technically refugees according to.
Well, okay, but they're speaking on behalf of members of their ethnic group who do not have rights in the sense that we do. They don't get due process of law on the West Bank and various other things. Israel's supposedly a democracy and it rules them, but they don't get to vote. And by the way, the settlements, I don't know if you've been on the West Bank, but it isn't just the settlements. They build roads among the settlements that the Palestinians aren't allowed to drive on and have trouble crossing. So increasingly, as the settlements grow, there's this web of confinement, and Palestinians who not that long ago could visit a cousin who lived 5 miles away now have a cousin who, for practical purposes, lives 25 miles away. But my main point is all the other ethnic groups have a state where members of that ethnic group can go and say, this is my state, I have rights. And there's no one, and the members of those ethnic groups don't have people who are in the position of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, which are different situations, but right?
Yeah, that is true. I think, but again, I think you're failing to distinguish what is important to you with your worldview from what is important to Palestinians. I think almost at every point in history, when choosing between whether to attack or delegitimate or work towards the destruction of Israel and whether to have a state, whenever those have come into conflict, those two goals, the first has won out over the second. In terms of what the, so I'm not saying Palestinians have no desire for a state. I'm saying throughout history, whether you're talking about 1947 or 2000, when those two have come into conflict, they have erred on the side of the decision that delegitimates Israel more than the decisions that would lead them to have a state, even a state that's currently demilitarized and maybe in 20 years with good faith. As we've done with other countries, once a country is peaceful for long enough, no one cares if you have a military, right? So I think in it's important to you that the Palestinians have a Palestinian state much more than it's important, obviously, for you to destroy Israel. You don't want to destroy Israel at all. Whereas I think that the simplest explanation, the only coherent explanation of Palestinian leaders' decision-making over the past 75 years is that the desire to get rid of Israel, as the sense that Israel is a fundamentally illegitimate colonial entity that we cannot compromise with, that has entered our homeland, dispossessed us, and needs to be destroyed, that has been priority number one. And that is the inability to let go of that priority is the reason that there's no Palestinian state.
Well, I've tried to give an account of those negotiations in which it seems to me you can understand Palestinian rejection without resorting to your explanation, without saying it means they didn't want a state. But
so how do you explain these zero, essentially zero compromise on the right of return?
I don't think that's where they were at the end. I think time ran out at Taba, and Arafat was saying things I know that were at least vaguely suggestive of room for compromise. I'll have to go back and revisit that. But again, if that's really the issue, and Israel wants to focus on that, be reasonable in other realms. But I'll go back and look at that. But again, Taba, time just ran out. That was a rush thing.
Easy is the wrong word. Look how clear the signal was from Anwar Sadat when Sadat really wanted peace and came to Knesset and said, made the famous speech that he made, and Israelis were in tears, having been, at this point, the Palestinian issue is not the main issue. Egypt is not only the historic enemy of Israel at this point in history, it's the enemy of Israel in the Bible. So there's a religious overlay to it, and it's the strongest enemy of Israel. It is the deepest Israeli fear is Egypt. Sadat comes to Israel, and he says, I'm sick of our kids dying, you're sick of your kids dying, let's end this. And it happens. Okay, it was not easy. There were all kinds of bitter negotiations so that each side trying to get the very best deal for itself. But there was a genuine desire on both sides to get the deal done, and the deal got done. Now, compare that to what you just said. There was some vague signal. Arafat gave some vague signal of compromise. I mean, that's not the signal people give when they really want a deal. Okay, this is how
neither is a 9-to-1 land ratio. I mean, you can argue this on both sides. The Egyptian thing is very different. It's a state that exists. Negotiations easier, and they're just different situations. I think I've tried to convey. You cannot. And I would also say you're attributing to you the fact that they turned down deals that you think they shouldn't have turned down. And again, they were not entirely formulated.
Well, I'm not saying they shouldn't have turned it down given their own preferences. I'm trying to explain in given their utility function and their sacred beliefs why they turned it down.
Right, but you're saying a sacred belief is Israel must be destroyed. You're attributing it to that.
That, yes, I would say that Palestinians have the right of return is close to a sacred belief among Palestinians. It's actually almost constitutive of the Palestinian national identity, in a way that makes it psychologically extremely difficult for Palestinians to compromise on Israel's existence, in a way that it's not for Egypt. Egypt has a national identity going back thousands of years that includes a lot of pride that has nothing to do with the Israel issue, whereas Palestinian national consciousness formed in the crucible of conflict with Jewish migration as a reaction to it. And so it is deeply tied to the sense that the Jews don't belong here in our land. They ought not have a state here in our land. And so it is much more difficult for Palestinians to compromise on those issues, which yes, as a third party Westerner, my belief set is that Jesus Christ, I want people on both sides of this conflict to stop fighting and stop dying. I want Israel and Palestine to be like America and Canada. And everything that is a barrier to them getting there on both sides seems to me just like unreason, right?
Mm-hmm.
But actually trying to step into the shoes of the Palestinian narrative from its own perspective, that narrative is that Israel is a colonial entity that does not belong there. And that's not like a ancillary part of the Palestinian national identity. That's at the core.
Mm-hmm. But, maybe you have different views about human nature. I think narratives can change. People can moderate. During World War I, Americans were literally executing dachshunds, dogs, because they were German, right? And if you look at things we were saying about the Japanese around, Time Magazine had a cover quoting this general. It said on it, kill more Japs. Attitudes change. And I would say, first of all, my view of human nature is that if you, have you been to the West Bank?
No.
Okay. Well, if you look at the conditions under, well, you can read the news and get the idea. I mean, the conditions under which they live, which is an Israeli soldier can at any point basically do anything they want. I just saw a video the other day, a settler torching a car with a Molotov cocktail that had belonged to a Palestinian who wasn't there. It was just an act of terrorism, while Israeli soldiers looked on and then they all just walked off. Okay, that's too often the reality there, and there are other things that make it. I haven't really gotten into the apartheid debate, but a lot of things in the West Bank that are kind of reminiscent of apartheid. But what I would say is the conditions are so bad. My belief about human nature is, if you started showing those people a world in which things were getting really better for them, you might be surprised by how willing they were to at least wait a year and see if they continued to get better. I think time and again, people who wanted to seriously experiment with exerting a moderating influence on Palestinians, including the radicals, have been thwarted by the American and or Israeli governments. And I want to give you one example that has to do with specifically with Hamas. You know, it's often said, well, two things are said. One is that Hamas won an election after Israel withdrew, that Hamas won an election in 2000, I think it was six. And the other thing is that they gained control of Gaza by a coup. And those two things seem kind of at odds, but you hear them both. And here is the reconciliation of the. Here's what happened. So the Bush administration had been pushing for elections. It said it's fine, you know, for Hamas to run. It didn't think Hamas would win. These were elections for the Legislative Council, which at that point had enough power that it was almost like a parliamentary system. This was going to give them more power than Abbas had as the nominally the executive head if Hamas won this election. Abbas, of course, represented Fatah. Well, Hamas won, a total of 44% of the vote, not a majority, but they won. And the Bush administration basically said, wait, we said you could run, we didn't say you could win. And so they set about doing a regime change operation. There was some good reporting on this done in Vanity Fair by David Rose. My friend John Judas wrote about it in the New Republic later. I tried to summarize their stuff in a piece in my Non-Zero newsletter called The Truth About Hamas. And so here's what happened. So the Bush administration got some people in Fatah and said, hey, we don't have to live with this. We can overthrow Hamas. It actually funneled weapons to them via Egypt. There was an attempted coup. There was a civil war. And ultimately, Hamas won. But in the middle of the civil war, Saudi Arabia tried to intervene, and they had a conference. And they brought together both sides of the, you know, both Palestinian camps, Fatah and Hamas. They thought they had a deal. Fatah and Hamas agreed that Hamas would handle domestic matters, and Fatah would handle international affairs, including negotiations with Israel. Hamas agreed to abide by the Oslo Accords and other existing treaties between the PLO and Israel. And they said, we'll support negotiations for a two-state solution. After the talks, Khalid Mashal, then the leader of Hamas, said Hamas is adopting a new political language. The Mecca Agreement is a new political language, and honoring the agreement is a new language because there's a new national need, and we must speak a language appropriate to the time. Now, was he sincere? We'll never know, because, of course, Israel didn't want it to happen. We know that Bibi Netanyahu, then as now, has wanted to avoid at all costs a unified government of Hamas and Fatah, because he does not want a two-state solution to happen. I doubt you'll contest that. We've heard that, you know, we've seen a lot of evidence of that. Well, I just want to say that the thwarting goes back that far, okay? And, you know, some people would say, look, this was just bullshit. They would never have moderated. I have a different view of human nature. It's not idealistic. It's actually cynical, which is that if you can make it in the material interests of Khalid Mashal and various other people to moderate, moderation can happen. And in fact, these negotiations were turning him into kind of an international celebrity. That's something you can build on, you know? That's a carrot, not a stick. But the point is, the way they sabotaged it was with the support of the U.S., the so-called quartet, which the U.S. was part of, demanded that Hamas go further and recognize Israel, okay, as a state. And, you know, anybody who knew the politics knew, like, you're asking for a pretty rapid 180 here. That's the kind of thing that's going to come down the road. You build on what you got. I mean, remember, Saudi Arabia still doesn't recognize Israel. Almost no Arabs, you know, aside from probably Egypt and Jordan, no Arab states recognized Israel, but they were on civil terms. But we were demanding that Hamas do it now. It was just, the point was to kill the deal. We killed the deal, the rest is history. So I just, all of this makes it like super hard for me to look at what's going on in Gaza and say, you know, you're right. The Palestinians had so many chances and they tried so hard to achieve peace. And the Israelis and Americans were so reasonable. It's just not true.
Okay, you know? So I want to get to the crux of what I think the disagreement is here. You say you think that people can change, historical narratives can change. Look at the way America and Japan were, you know, enemies and are now friends. America and Germany, bitter enemies during World War II, etc. There's a fundamental difference between these situations that I think explains quite a bit. The identity of Americans was not in the first instance related to the Japanese or in any way against the Japanese, right? They were a discrete wartime problem. They were not constitutive of the American identity in general in, like, you know, the 1800s or early 1900s. Americans didn't think about Japan, didn't care about Japan. Many didn't know about Japan. Americans probably knew about Germany because there were so many German immigrants in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But the American identity had nothing to do with Germany, had nothing to do with disliking Germany or liking Germany for that matter. We were at war with Germany, and as you know, when nations go to war, there is always a flare up of hatred on both sides, as you know, wartime propaganda, wartime passions. After those wars, which were probably single months in those wars that were more brutal in terms of lives lost than the entire history of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, somehow we easily became friends. Or not, you know, without too much difficulty, we became friends with Germany. We became friends with Japan after dropping two atomic bombs on them.
Right.
And somehow that didn't do what you're worrying about in Gaza. It didn't create a bunch of anti-American Japanese terrorists that have created, like, it hasn't created an intractable problem with anti-American sentiment in Japan, which you would assume the only two examples of the biggest bomb used ever, invented ever, would create that kind of backlash effect, except for the fundamental difference between these situations, which is that our identity as Americans has nothing to do with Japan or Germany, whereas the Palestinian identity formed and forged its whatever its sacred beliefs are directly tied to being against Jewish dispossession of land and Jewish statehood and Jewish migration into historic Palestine. That is at the crux, and it's not actually the same on the other side. The identity of Israeli Jews is not premised on being anti-Palestinian. The Jews have their own sacred beliefs related to the Torah and the narrative of the Jewish people and so forth. The Palestinian identity is centered on this issue, and I think many groups of people have beliefs that are sacred to them that don't admit of compromise. And that's at the core of this. That's what explains so all the things that you're talking about the quartet, you're talking about our meddlesome, self-contradictory foreign policy in 2005. I don't disagree with you, Bob. We you could go down the line on American foreign policy mistakes, and I would probably agree with you 70-80% on the dumb mistakes that we have made. It's not the crux of the issue. You attribute too much importance to it and not enough importance to the fundamentals. In my view, you miss the forest for the trees. The fundamental issue. And this is what explains, this is in trying to have the simplest, most elegant explanation, not only of Palestinian terrorism since 2005, not only in the 90s and 80s, but also before the occupation started, the founding of the PLO in 1964, the Palestinian attack on the Yishuv, the pre-state Jewish community in 1947. What ties it all together is is this fundamental fact that the Palestinian identity is, in some sense, equal to the belief that the Jews don't belong in historic Palestine, and that they're colonizers themselves, and that they're an arm of colonial entities, and initially Britain, and now America, and that they can be driven out the way that other indigenous peoples have driven out colonizers in the past. That is a deep, sacred feeling in Palestinian identity, and that's what makes this conflict unlike the. That's what makes it so intractable. That's what makes it unlike the examples that you're tempted to point to in history where we've become friends. Yeah,
first of all, I mean, I just meant those as generic examples of the fact that attitudes can change. People who once viewed themselves to be fundamentally in conflict can change their minds and so on. But, you know, if you want an example closer of people moderating, groups moderating, well, the Palestinian Liberation Organization at one point had an ideology like Hamas's. They wanted to destroy the Zionist entity, and they thought killing civilians was a legitimate way to do it. They renounced those views. They recognized the right of Israel to exist. So this can happen, to some extent at least, in the very context we're talking about. So what happened when he said, well, let's take this party that central to the PLO, Fatah, that is somewhat more moderate, give it this unity government with Hamas that they both say they want. Hamas is professing to be moderate. Let's see what happens. Well, we didn't want to do the experiment. And so we broke it up. And I'm just saying that your hypothesis that there's some kind of essentialism in Palestinian hostility toward Israel, which is indeed considerable, but the hypothesis that it's so firmly entrenched that nothing works against it other than war. I'm just trying to argue every time we've had a chance to actually test that hypothesis, we have failed to do it. And by the way, the Oslo Accords, another thing the PLO did is said, okay, we'll do the Oslo Accords. What did Israel do during, the Oslo Accords were supposed to move us toward a resolution. We knew that at the end of the road, these settlements would still be a nettlesome issue. What did Israel do? They kept building settlements during the Oslo Accords. Now, Israel has their complaints about Palestine, or how the Palestinians behaved during the Oslo Accords. I'm not an expert, but it does seem to me that Israel, if you really want to give them a chance, why not a little moratorium on settlements, A? And B, why didn't the U.S. push for that? Why didn't the U.S. get it? And here, I mean, I don't want to change the subject, but we do get back to the speech code that I'm saying people like Barry Weiss have been trying to enforce, which was that if you proposed things that ran afoul of kind of the more ardent pro-Israel forces in America, you could pay a price. For example, Jimmy Carter published a book more than 20 years ago called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. He wasn't saying Israel was an apartheid state. He was saying, if you don't solve the problem, that's where you're headed. And I think events have borne him out. But he took so much heat, he apologized. He apologized for saying even that. Okay. And, you know, the Anti-Defamation, he went and consulted the Anti-Defamation League, which I think helps enforce the speech code. It's funny, I had Ron Campius on the podcast. He's this really, really excellent journalist at Jewish Telegraphic Agency. And as if I'm recalling the story correctly, they steered him to Ron for absolution. You know, they said, well, go talk, you know, JTA is a respected outlet. Go talk to them and, you know, say the right things and we will forgive you. But this was a president of the United States saying something totally defensible, and he had to apologize. And I really believe that this has, made it hard to address the problem. And now I regret to see a situation in which you're seeing more extreme anti-Israel rhetoric on campuses than you ever saw back when you know, than the things that were previously prohibited. But I do think one reason it's come to this is because the U.S. has not exerted the leverage it might have if it really had Israel's interests at heart. And I think one reason is the speech code policing. But I kind of detracted us. I kind of pushed us off the trail. So respond to either or both of the issues that are now in play.
Okay. So one thing I want to I would want to push back on is that the idea that the PLO moderated to such a degree as to testify to the possibility of like a lot or the plausibility of a lot more moderation. Yes, I agree. You know, Arafat was a pure militant for much of his life, and then he became a leader and a politician and a peacemaker in quotation marks, or at least it looked like that in the 90s. But then you had the Second Intifada. And my understanding is that the Palestinian Authority continued its martyr fund throughout all of that, if not even, you know, I mean, I actually don't know to the extent the Palestinian Authority had a hand in egging on the Second Intifada. That is something that's beyond my research, but it's something people have said. And they certainly continued paying the families of people that blew up Israelis, including Israeli citizens. So to moderate from actually being a terrorist group to simply incentivizing it, funding it, we're not talking about Nelson Mandela.
No, but remember about the timeframes we're talking about. So they moderate, they say, we'll try Oslo. Roughly, you know, I mean, a lot of years go by. This is Oslo is what, early 90s? The Second Intifada is after both Camp David and Taba have failed. I'm not defending
it. I think it starts after, in between Camp David and Taba, no? When Sharon visits the Temple Mount?
That could be.
Maybe I have the timeline wrong.
I don't know, but we agree. So Sharon, I guess it was Sharon, paid that, what everyone knew would be this provocative, possibly incendiary visit to the Temple Mountain and the rest. And the Second Intifada. But I'm just saying that, look, opportunities for moderation and peace come. And then, you know, if they don't blossom, yeah, they eventually go. And the Second Intifada, First Intifada had been largely throwing rocks at soldiers and killing some soldiers. It wasn't basically directed at civilians. That was in the late 80s. And by the way, I mean, what Palestinians will say is like, the only reason we got Oslo is because of that degree of violence. You know, some soldiers were killed, maybe a few civilians, but they would make the point that like, when we just sit here and don't do some form of uprising, nothing happens. That's their line. But the main point I'd make is, once the Second Intifada broke out, I'm not exactly sure on the timeline either, whether it was a month before or a month after Taba, but no, all bets were off once you start blowing up pizza parlors in Tel Aviv. But that doesn't mean there were not opportunities in the meanwhile. That, who knows if they hadn't built settlements during Oslo and various other things had happened, and if the Palestinians had been reasonable in other ways. A frustration for me is that I do not think the U.S. has used its leverage the way it could have to move the situation toward peace and stability.
That's probably true. I mean, I'm not going to defend the idea that the America has made every chess move correctly or even close to correctly. Or even plausibly could. I mean, there's better and worse diplomacy, but there's never perfect diplomacy. I just don't think that that's the crux of the issue here. Look at, something you just mentioned. I think it's interesting. You say these things in passing. We all say these things in passing. The idea that obviously Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount was provocative. Everyone knew it would be provocative. Well, why mm-hmm. is it provocative? From a third-party atheist perspective here, Coleman Hughes, atheist American, you've got two religions. You've got one where the Temple Mount is the holiest site to them, and another mm-hmm. where it's the third holiest site. So looking from a symmetric outsider third party perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to me either is Muslims visiting that site provocative to Jews? Not exactly, right? But a Jew visiting that site is provocative to Muslims. Well, why is that? Well, if you actually look at it, if you were to ask someone like Arafat, why is that provocative? He would say because there was never a temple there, because Jews were never here.
Okay, but right? that's not why I would say it was predictably provocative. It was predictably provocative because, as I understand it, there had been rules governing that. Some were maybe Israeli laws. I mean, remember, this wasn't part of Israel before 1967. So that's one reason the Muslims, I mean, you're right, the most important site, you know, holy site in all of Judaism is there. Unfortunately, as history has had it, on top of it is a mosque that is not the most sacred thing in Islam. It's sometimes said the third most sacred, whatever. To me, none of that is, if you want to ask why was it predictable, it was, as I understand it, I'd have to look into this, but I think, you know, a combination of rules and norms had developed over when Israelis could and couldn't visit there, what they could and couldn't do, and this was new. And in fact, Sharon had to get permission from the government, as I understand it, to go. And for whatever reason, Ehud Barak gave it to him. But that's how unusual it was. And remember, Sharon's not just like a tourist. He's this right-wing guy who already had a lot of blood on his hands, including the blood of civilians. If you look at what happened in Lebanon, right? I mean, he countenanced and facilitated the slaughter of an entire refugee camp, or at least all the males in the refugee camp.
Right. Fair enough. But I think from a 10,000-foot view, the reason that this is provocative to Palestinians is the same reason why, according to Shlomo Ben-Ami, at no point during the negotiations in Camp David and after would Arafat agree to recognize that the Jews had had a temple there. Because, and again, this is totally symbolic recognition. All he would have to do is say the words, and he would get something he allegedly wanted in return, but he couldn't do it. Why is that? Because, as is my thesis in this particular conversation, there is a sacred belief among that is constitutive and central to Palestinian identity, which has to do with the illegitimacy of the Jewish presence in historic Palestine.
Yeah, I mean, it's just as a sociological matter. It is fairly common for groups that see themselves as oppressed, and in this case, I think if you look at the actual lives of Palestinians in the occupied territory, we can remove the part about see themselves. I mean, they're oppressed. It's fairly common for them to develop narratives that strike us as crazy. You see, for example, among some low income urban black populations, conspiracy theories that might strike us as crazy. It's like a sociological fact that it happens, and certain things become denied that are the case, and so on. So if you want to ask me, why does it happen? Things like that happen. I don't really understand why they were so intent on him uttering the words. It seems to me, you know, there are words probably that are true about the past that you could not get an Israeli politician to utter, right? They'd rather emphasize one side.
They have, this is my point though, they have sacred beliefs too, but their sacred beliefs are Jewish sacred beliefs. Have to do with narratives in the Torah, with this kind of thing. They don't have to do with the Palestinians. They don't have to do with the illegitimacy of the Palestinians. This is why throughout history, Israelis have not had a problem with living next to a peaceful Palestinian state. If God himself came down and said, here, if you both sign on this dotted line, you're going to get a peaceful Israeli state and a peaceful Palestinian state, and it's going to be like America and Canada. At most points in Israeli history, Israelis would be okay with that. Palestinians would not. Because well, Israeli identity is not premised on the negation of the Palestinian identity, the same way the Palestinian identity is premised on the negation of Jewish legitimacy in that land.
Well, I've already indicated why I don't think Israeli negotiating positions bear out what you're saying about how interested they were in giving the Palestinians an actual state. But look, the situation is highly asymmetrical. You know, Israeli Jews have full rights. They can vote in an election. If they get accused of a crime, they get due process. And the Palestinians are in a very different situation. There will predictably be all kinds of asymmetries of attitude in a situation like that. Where I differ from you is I think you hear what some Palestinians say about Israel, and many of them will say very bad things about Israel. I would say many more now than 8 months ago. You, I think, might argue that, no, it's just this essential part of their character.
Not character.
Well, what? Okay, of their culture, but there's something essentialist
national identity, sacred national beliefs.
Okay, but there's something essentialist to me about your conception of national identity that I don't share because I've seen national identities change. It's a huge challenge, but I think to return to the practical level, I just think Israel is making things. Well, you tell me. Okay, we talked about Carter's book, Peace, Not Apartheid. I've been saying for some time, I don't see this ending in any way other than either apartheid or ethnic cleansing. I think right now, a number of Israeli officials would like to do the wholesale ethnic cleansing of Gaza. I don't know if that'll happen. You can point to some of the people in the cabinet who it's safe to say want that. And some would argue Israel is acting like they would like that. But in any event, I think that could happen. I think it's hard to argue too strenuously against characterizing what's happening in the West Bank as apartheid already. And it's just getting worse and worse and worse. Ethnic cleansing is going on, you know, this week. Violent ethnic cleansing. And so I'm wondering.
You say, like, it's going on this week?
It's going on every week.
I mean, being cleansed to?
Smaller and smaller pockets of the West Bank. They're being intimidated out of their villages. You look at there's a UN tabulation of number of displaced people in the West Bank, and I don't know if they've updated it lately, but like pretty much in any given week there's some.
Okay, but more, talking about Gaza. That's why I asked that question.
Oh no! I was talking about the West Bank. It's okay. Happening in kind of slow motion in the West Bank. Some would argue the whole settlement movement has been a form of legalistic slow motion ethnic cleansing, and this is its culmination. But if we follow the approach you favor, which is so-called, you know, cutting out the cancer and basically relying on a strictly military approach to solving this. And look, at this point, I don't have an obvious way out myself. A lot of my complaint is that I think earlier there was more in the way of a way out. So it's not like I'm saying, oh, two-state solution should be easy at this point. There are creative ideas about one state federation, some of them from Israeli Jews like Dalia Scheindlin, I think. Look, at this point it's very tough, but I guess my question to you is, do you see anything in the future other than enduring apartheid-like conditions in the West Bank and or Gaza and or some degree of ethnic cleansing? Is there any hope for anything else?
I don't really like to make predictions because most predictions are wrong, and I don't, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. So I don't know. I don't know how this situation is going to evolve in the future. I don't think anyone does. The optimistic gloss is that often people don't, you know, you can get to a solution without having seen, without it having seemed possible in the past, because things can change for the better. Time can be, time can work to the advantage of the situation. It can also work to the detriment. So I don't know what is going to happen. But I do know that, Israel has a duty to its citizens to prevent them from, you know, dying indiscriminately at the hands of terrorists. Has it prosecuted this duty perfectly? Far from it, although no nation state has. It faces unique levels of threat in terms of the number of militant groups, and including Iran, that seem to want it eradicated. And so it has to manage the problem. And in the absence of a political way to manage that problem, they have to use their military to manage it. What's the point of forming states if you're going to allow a terrorist group on your border that does what Hamas does? I mean, we might as well live in anarchy. So, I am sympathetic with the situation Israel faces. And I think it's intractable, not because of American incompetence, not because of poor American diplomacy, poor Israeli diplomacy. I think it is intractable because it involves narratives, a narrative in particular on the Palestinian side that is unlike the national identity narrative that obtains in most putatively similar conflicts. It's not an accident, in other words, that this conflict has lasted as long as it has. It's not because the diplomacy has been so much worse than the diplomacy in other conflicts. The American meddling has been so much worse. The lobbying has been so much worse. It's because of the basic physics of the concept of the conflict in terms of the narrative. Now, I'm not saying that can't change, but I think that that's a more accurate description in terms of what's important about this conflict relative to the kinds of legitimate concerns that you've been bringing up throughout the podcast.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I of course disagree with some of that, but we had said we'd talk for 90 minutes. I'm happy to go on, a little longer. But you may have things. So
I've got 5 minutes if you want.
Well, I wouldn't say the lobbying isn't worse. I mean, in this case, I would say the Israel lobby, construed broadly, is a particularly powerful lobby. The Cuba lobby is also very powerful, and I think has led to an equally irrational policy on our part that has been equally bad for the country. But in this case, the lobby wants it to be bad for the country, at least in Cuba. You know, I would say that with Israel, they ostensibly are supporting Israel. I think, for reasons I've spelled out, a lot of the policies they've defended and favored and exerted influence on behalf have not been in Israel's interest, including really the current one. I think it's a problem. What's happening to Israel in the world's opinion is a problem. There's the danger of wider war, which I think in some ways maybe Bibi welcomes as a political matter. But of course, this is one of the great, I mean, the crazy thing about this is everyone said right away, you know, it's in Bibi's political interest to prolong this war, maybe expand it. And then it's like, okay, let's trust Bibi. I mean, they did create a war cabinet, but
yeah, all the decisions are unity decisions by the war cabinet.
They are, I suppose. Well, let me ask you,
the opposition in the war cabinet.
Let me ask you this maybe final question. So did you think, the strike on the Iranian consulate that killed, I mean, there are two things. It was that and the kind of unprecedentedly high level of the officials being killed. Both of those were an issue from Iran's point of view. That's turned out to be a political win for Bibi, I think. I think in the polls have actually, his favorability has actually gone up since the whole exchange. Hmm. That's the kind of thing, like the fact that he didn't give us a heads up about that, I just find that completely unacceptable, given how much support we're giving him. But do you think that was like, do you support the strike? Do you agree with me that actually he should have given us significant advance notice, maybe even veto power?
So I don't, to the first question, I don't really have a strong opinion. To me, I think often what is right in kind of strategic game theory war situations only reveals itself in retrospect, because there's so much uncertainty with how all of these things can either spin out into catastrophes, or actually, on the other hand, lead to really kind of wise settlements. On the other hand, as an American, we support Israel so much, it would make sense that they would give us some heads up. I would certainly want that.
Would have been nice. So listen, you know, I had said we were going to talk for an hour and then the paywall was going to come down, but I'm not bringing it down. It just, you know, in other words, after that, it would be available only to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which I normally do. I didn't do it. It just seemed like the kind of conversation you don't want to interrupt, and you give anybody, want to give anybody who heard the first part access to the last part. Mm. I would encourage anyone who commends me for that and isn't at least an unpaid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter to become one of those. Maybe rate and review the podcast, smash the like button, so on, and conceivably even become a paid subscriber. But I'd also say, first of all, people should check out your stuff, Conversations with Coleman. And Coleman, this is a real pleasure for me that, you know, we've had a civil conversation, a lot of conversations about this get more heated. A lot of conversations involving me get more heated because I think more volatile than you are. But I've done my best to not do any screaming. And I think this has been super valuable. If you want to, first of all, say anything final about this, the issue, I'll give you the last word. And then tell us anything you want to plug other than your book, The End of Race Politics, Arguments for a Colorblind America, and your podcast.
Yeah, so I've exhausted this topic. I don't know if there's much more to say right now, but read my book, The End of Race Politics, on a totally different issue, maybe with some kind of relevancies a little bit, but really more focused on America and racial politics here. And listen to my podcast, Conversations with Coleman.
All right.
Thank you for having me on, Bob. I really appreciate these conversations too. I appreciate the way that you carry yourself as a conversation haver.
Thank you. Not everyone who's had one of those with me agrees, but I appreciate that. And I have a lot of respect for your enterprise as well. And congratulations on everything. Isn't there some kind of like music stuff you want to plug on YouTube or anything?
Yeah, I have music videos. I have an album on Spotify. Everyone can go check that out.
Okay. And I'm thinking about putting out an album, but I haven't yet. I'll let people know if I do. All right. Thanks, Coleman.
All right. Thanks.